Today we're going to complete the Book of the Covenant. This is part four of this part of Exodus. In our last lesson, we continued our study of the Book of the Covenant, looking specifically at laws pertaining to theft, sorcery, bodily injury, and the Sabbath year observance. And we compared some of these laws in the Mosaic legislation to those that were contained in the Code of Hammurabi. And we saw how the value of human life was elevated by the Mosaic law. We saw also how the Code of Hammurabi, which was representative of the legal thinking of the day, formed a context for many of the Mosaic laws. Today we're going to look at the laws concerning feasts and sacred seasons, and we're going to look at the closing words of the Book of the Covenant that point forward to the conquest. Let's begin by reading in chapter 23 of Exodus, beginning with verse 13, and I will read through verse 19 for our first section today. Now concerning everything which I've said to you, be on your guard. Do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. Three times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe, and here's the first feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For 7 days you're to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Aviv. For in it you came up out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Here's the second feast. Also you shall observe the Feast of the Harvest of the First Fruits of your labor for what you sow in the field. And the third feast is the Feast of Ingathering, at the end of the year when you gather in the fruit of your labor from the field. This is not the end of the calendar year, but at the end of the agricultural year. Then in verse 17, three times a year all of your males shall appear before the Lord God. Notice back in 14, it begins with the phrase three times a year. Then verse 17 begins with the phrase three times a year. And I'm going to just point that out as we are going through this reading. There's a comment I'm going to make about that later, because in Hebrew, they're different phrases. Verse 18, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil up to the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. Verse 13 begins by stating, now regarding everything that I've said to you, I believe this refers back to what has just been said about the stranger, the sojourner, who was just mentioned in verses 10 and 12. We talked about that last week. Strangers were to be treated with compassion, but their religion was to be avoided at all costs. Consequently, the Israelites were admonished to be on guard. The ease with which these peoples could be swayed to the worldview of the Canaanite neighbors that would surround them in the land requires diligence in order to avoid apostasy. I can't emphasize how true that was then and how true it remains today. In every age, our age included, there is a correct way to view and understand God's creation and his relationship to it, and there's a satanic alternative. It was a problem for Israel in their time. It's a problem for us today in America. Specifically, Moses says to Israel, you're not to mention the name of any other god. This doesn't necessarily mean that the name of the god could not be uttered, but it means that that god should not be called upon in an oath, in a prayer, or in any way that could confuse the practice of pure worship in Israel with the pagan worship of the Canaanites. This would have included any context that they encountered in the land that involved idolatrous worship, the agricultural festivals and the Canaanite feast. All of these things were contexts for idolatry. And just as a side note, Some of the feasts we're going to talk about today are indeed related to the agricultural cycle. And so it's not hard to understand that the Canaanites also observe feasts such as these. However, the theological intent of the feasts are what distinguished them. And a lot of people have tried to make a big deal out of the fact that the Canaanite had agricultural feasts that were observed, and the Israelites simply borrowed those. Nothing could be further from the truth. Verses 14 through 19, to protect Israel from the idolatry that's going to surround them in Canaan, Israel is going to have her own festivals structured around the worship of Yahweh. And this, you can almost look back on how we approach the plagues. Remember, we looked at those as polemics. A polemic was an attack on a surrounding worldview or culture, using some of the same symbols, perhaps, of that worldview or culture, but attributing new and fuller and different meanings to those symbols. So even though there are going to be agricultural feasts and festivals going on among the Canaanites, Israel's going to have her own, and her feasts and her festivals are going to be focused on the worship of Yahweh, and therefore the theological content of that act of worship is going to be vastly different from that of the Canaanites. Micah said, don't the feasts go toward the difference in religion and faith? And they can certainly be viewed that way. The Canaanites were trying to manipulate their gods through their feasts. That's the bottom line of a Canaanite feast or festival. There's a big long term called mythopoeic logic, which simply means that if I do certain things down here, then the god has to do certain things up there, and by going through these religious rituals, I manipulate the god. That's mythopoeic logic. That is actually the thinking that went behind all of the agricultural religions of the ancient Near East, Canaanites included. However, the feasts and festivals that Israel is going to celebrate are based on sound theological doctrine, and that's the difference. Now, I mentioned earlier this phrase, three times a year. In verse 14, this says, three times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. And then in verse 17, three times a year your males shall appear before the Lord your God. This is a bit of an odd phrase. In verse 14, the phrase is shalosh rigalim. It literally means 3 feet. So if you translated this literally, verse 14 would say 3 feet a year. That's odd. Then when you get down to verse 17, it's shalosh pi'amim, which means 3 beats. So if you were to translate these two things, 14 says 3 feet a year, and verse 17 says 3 beats a year. The reason I think that it says 3 feet a year is that these festivals ultimately became pilgrimage festivals to which people walked. And down in verse 17, that term translated beats came to imply anything that was rhythmic. And it came to be used metaphorically for the word steps, such as in the term footsteps. So this is related to how these festivals are going to develop over the centuries and over the years, and they will be pilgrimage festivals once the temple is in place in Jerusalem, to which people will walk rhythmically, taking step after step to arrive at these places to worship the Lord. Verses 15 and 16 list the specific festivals that Israel is going to observe, though we're really given very few details here in Exodus about the festivals. The three festivals in question comprise the three main events in Israel's religious calendar, probably because they represent the three major physical aspects of life in the land. These things would be the harvest of grain, and this is kind of important to understand. Barley was planted in the winter. So the first harvest, when you read about the first harvest of grain, you're talking about the barley harvest. About 7 weeks later, you have the beginning of the other cereal grains, specifically wheat. That begins about 50 days after the barley harvest, and then that leads on into the big harvest in the autumn, which was the largest harvest of the three. These festivals are built around these three stages of harvest: the barley harvest, followed by the wheat and other cereal grains, followed by the big harvest in the autumn. So the first feast that the Jews are to observe is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we studied in detail back in Exodus chapter 12, which of course includes the celebration of the Passover. Remember, this feast, as opposed to the others, memorializes the Exodus from Egypt. Although in the context of Exodus 23, the focus is not so much on the Exodus as it is on the agricultural festival from which the unleavened barley cakes will be derived, which are used in the festival of unleavened bread and the Passover. Keep in mind now, the Canaanites have their own agricultural feast, which makes sense. They're harvesting crops as well. But this particular feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, is uniquely Jewish, for it was only Israel that was delivered from the house of bondage in Egypt. The people are told, "No one shall come before me empty-handed." If we look over in Exodus chapter 34, particularly verses 18 through 20, this is explained a little bit more fully. Here Moses is also talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Verse 18, he says, "You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the appointed time of the month of Aviv. For in the month of Aviv you came out of Egypt." That's almost verbatim of 23:15. Verse 19, "The first offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock, the first offspring from cattle and sheep. You shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey, and if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons. None shall appear before me empty-handed." What God is expecting at this feast is the acknowledgement of his gift of the early barley harvest, the early grain, and he's looking for thanksgiving for the beginning of a new agricultural year. These are the things he wants the people to understand, because this is how God takes care of his people. So we then come to the second feast, which is called the Feast of Harvest, or it's also called the Feast of Harvests of the First Fruits of Your Labor. It came to be called the Festival, or the Festival of First Fruits. This is primarily the wheat harvest. It was beginning of the autumn harvest, but it was early. It was summer. This is also known as the Feast of Sevens. If you look over in chapter 34 again of the first part of 22, it says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks." Keep in mind the Hebrew word for week and seven is the same word. So he says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks," that is the first fruit of the wheat harvest. So that's what's in view here. And it came exactly 7 weeks after the barley harvest, the early harvest of barley. What's interesting, if you look at Deuteronomy 16, beginning with verse 9, he says, "You shall count 7 weeks for yourself," seven sevens, literally. "You shall begin to count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain." Here the standing grain is the barley. "Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, and your son and your daughter, your male and female servants, the Levite who is in your town, the stranger and the orphan, the widow who are in your midst, in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe his statutes." So this is called the Feast of Weeks. It describes the period of time from the beginning of the barley harvest to the end of the wheat harvest. And particularly pertinent here is Leviticus chapter 23, verse 16. You don't have to turn there. It simply says, "You shall count 50 days to the day of the seventh Sabbath. Then you shall present a new grain offering." This came to be known as Pentecost, because Pentecost means 50. And it was the time of great celebration in the land of Israel. The third feast is the Feast of Ingathering, and it was celebrated at the end of the agricultural year. It was the largest of the festivals, because the autumn harvest is the largest of the harvests. And this term, ingathering, is not referring just to the harvest of the grain, but it's the actual putting an end to the whole process. If you, we don't need to turn there, but if you look at Deuteronomy 16:13, it says, when all the wine is from the wine presses and the wheat and the grain are from the threshing floors, then you bring in everything, and that's the time when in gathering is considered having been done. The grapes are out of the wine press. The grains are not on the threshing floor any longer. They're gathered into storehouses. Then the feast was celebrated. This became the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. And it can best be described, if you want to think about how to understand this in words that we might be familiar with today, this is sort of like Thanksgiving for Israel. It's thankfulness for the bounty of the harvest. Verses 17 through 19 close out the book of the covenant except for the epilogue. And there are some miscellaneous instructions that are given here which seem somewhat disconnected when we first read these. For example, three times a year all the males must appear before Yahweh. And we presume this means wherever the tabernacle may be located at that time. Another is the blood sacrifice must be offered without leaven. Fat of a sacrifice shall not remain till morning. Only the best of the first fruits will be as acceptable as an offering, and, in case any of you were tempted, a young goat shall not be boiled in its mother's milk. I know this sounds rather odd, but these words are actually used three different times in the Old Testament. They're used here in Exodus 23, over in the 34th chapter, and also in Deuteronomy 14. I believe these prohibitions were put into the Mosaic Code to distinguish the worship of Israel from the pagan practices of the Canaanites who practiced all these things in their worship. I thought I would just take one example out of here to make this point. Obviously, I picked the most colorful one. You are not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. On May the 14th, 1929, in a place called Ugarit, Syria, I've written this up here for you, Ugarit, Syria, in Arabic, it's called Rosh Shamra, or Tel Rosh Shamra. An archaeologist named Claude Schaefer made a discovery that greatly expanded our understanding of ancient Near Eastern languages and culture. He found over 1,000 cuneiform tablets that date just after the time of Moses, 12th to 14th century. The language in which they were written came to be known as Ugaritic. So the site name is called Ugarit. The language is called Ugaritic. Ugaritic is an interesting language. It's probably very similar, if not almost identical, to the language spoken by Moses, and in fact the language in which he would append the Pentateuch. This is one of three paperbacks for my Ugaritic class. I bought this in 1974 for $60. That was a fortune. I think they only printed nine of them. This is what Ugaritic looks like. Now, it looks very different from Hebrew. It actually looks like a chicken got loose. What this actually is, in actuality, these would be three-dimensional characters. They would take a reed and cut it at an angle and then press that reed down into clay and create three-dimensional characters. So this is called cuneiform writing. This is the script. In fact, this is Ugaritic. This is the script of the place called Ugarit. If you want to look at this later, you're welcome to. A large part of the Ugaritic tablets are Canaanite religious texts. Some have called them the Canaanite Bible because they contain prescriptions for the worship of the god Baal, whose name appears in the Hebrew Bible. In one particular tablet called The Birth of the Beautiful Gods, there's a list of ritual commands that appear there. One of these commands includes these words, "You shall boil a goat in milk." Isn't that interesting? Well, this particular commandment is in a section of this tablet 52 that's heavily damaged, and it's damaged on both sides before and after this particular phrase, so we don't have the entire context available to us. But Most scholars who have looked at this believe that this tablet describes a pagan Canaanite ceremony in which a young goat is boiled alive in its mother's milk as a sacrifice. If that's the proper interpretation of this, then you get a picture of the culture in which Israel is going and why God would have said, don't do this. Don't let your worship of me, which is a pure worship based on faith, be confused in any way with those things that the pagans are going to do in Canaan. I believe that when we read some of these laws in the Mosaic legislation, they just seem odd to us. Like, why would anyone be tempted to boil a goat in milk? Well, it's because that was the culture. So a lot of things that may appear to us to be arbitrary because we don't understand the cultural background may well be explained by the world in which the Israelites were going to be asked to live and to preserve a pure faith in that culture. This brings us to the epilogue, which is included in verses 20 through 33. Here Israel is going to be instructed very minimally at this point about the conquest. So let's read, beginning with verse 20 through verse 33. Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I've prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. But if you will truly obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites and the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I'll remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I'll fulfill the number of your days. I'll send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the peoples with whom you come into contact, and I'll make all of your enemies turn their backs to you, that is, turn and run. I'll send hornets ahead of you, they may drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I'll not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. But I'll drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. I'll fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, that's the Mediterranean, from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand and will drive them out from before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they'll make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Well, just as the ordinances and laws and statutes of the Book of the Covenant were introduced by a prologue, so they're concluded here by an epilogue in which the Israelites are promised protection and success if they're faithful to the covenant that God's making with them. This last section of the Book of the Covenant, verses 20 through 33, really do form a fitting conclusion, because here it mentions that God will send his angel who will lead the Israelites during the conquest, and it also recalls for us two themes which we've previously seen in the book of Exodus. The first theme is Israel's worship. The people were redeemed out of slavery in Egypt in order to serve God and not Pharaoh. The second theme that we saw is found in the specific mention here of the promised land. Regarding Israel's worship, God has fought for Israel. He's led them through the sea and he's led them through the desert. He's provided for them, and he said of himself, I'm jealous of you, the people I've redeemed. I think we see here in this context that redemption must always lead to worship. And it's this relationship between redemption and worship that God wants to emphasize here for Israel. The Book of the Covenant is really about Israel's proper conduct toward her God. Even those sections on the horizontal relationship, that is, how relationships should exist among the Israelites themselves, these have implications for how Israel is to relate to Yahweh, her God. Each, in its own way, is an expression of worship. Here, in an unusual fashion, the text has turned from a recitation of these laws and statutes to this mention of the conquest. And this is not hard to understand. If we flip back just quickly to Exodus 15, you remember in this context they've just come through the Red Sea. That is laid out for us in narrative in Exodus 14. And then in Exodus 15, we have this poetic section where Moses reiterates what God has done for Israel. And in verses 14 through 16, listen to what he says. The peoples have heard. That is, they've heard about the plagues. They've heard about the Red Sea. The people have heard and they tremble. These people would be the non-Israelites, the surrounding peoples. They've heard what happened. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted. Terror, there's our word. Terror and dread fall upon them by the greatness of your arm, that is, by your power. They're motionless as stone. They stand in fear, petrified. Until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purchased. And in that term, purchased, is the theme of redemption. From the moment that Israel stepped onto the east bank of the Red Sea, the attention and focus of the story began to change from escape from Egypt to the conquest of Canaan. This change in perspective is evidenced in the Book of the Covenant because its laws form a manifesto for how Israel is to conduct life, not back in Egypt, not in the desert, but how they're to conduct life in the land promised to them under the Abrahamic covenant. By focusing on worship and conquest together, Moses reiterates for Israel and for us as students of the book of Exodus what's come before, and he prepares them for what's coming later, taking possession of the land promised to Abraham and his descendants. Proper worship is going to be the main concern through the rest of the book of Exodus. We're going to see the instructions regarding the tabernacle and all the symbolism associated with that. While the conquest, though not the emphasis any longer in the book of Exodus, the conquest will dominate the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy, Joshua, and Judges. If you want to look at this from a slightly different perspective, the first 18 chapters of Exodus prepared Israel for this theophany at the Mount Sinai and the giving of the law. This final section then points forward to the possession of the land. Now, considering verses 20 through 26, there are two parts to this grouping of verses. Each part contains a command followed by the consequences of obeying or disobeying that command. The first has to do with listening to the angel, that is, to obeying him. Obeying the angel will result in the Canaanites being driven out of the land before the Israelites. And worshiping only Yahweh and not being entangled in the Canaanite religious practices, that is, obeying the commandments God has already given to Israel, will bring well-being, abundant natural resources, water and food, health, and multiple descendants. The object of obedience in the first instance is this angel. In the second instance, it's God. And this leads to the question of the identity of the angel. Is the angel a messenger who is a representative of God to the people, or is the angel the manifestation of God himself? I'll be honest with you, in the Old Testament, sometimes it's not easy to determine, and sometimes the best we can do is point out the close association between the angel of the Lord and God himself. Here's what we can say with certainty. This angel's been intimately involved with Israel's redemption throughout the book of Exodus. He was present when God called Moses. If you remember back to Exodus 3:2, it says, the angel of the Lord appeared in the blazing fire of the bush. Didn't say God did. It said the angel of the Lord appeared. So this angel was present at Moses' call to service. If you recall, the angel also led Israel through the wilderness, and it is this angel who positioned himself between the Israelites and the Egyptian army at the Red Sea. So he was closely involved with saving Israel. We're also going to see him again in 32 verse 34 and 33 verse 2 in the context of the conquest. The people are told to listen to him and to obey him in verse 21. In fact, God says, my name is in him. You can't help but think when you hear the term God's name, to think back to chapter 3 where this angel and the name of God, Yahweh, are brought together. So it's very hard to avoid the conclusion that God and the angel are the same person. I think this question is resolved in verse 22 when we look at the syntax of this verse. Think about verse 22. He says, if you obey his voice, that is the angel's voice, and you do what I say, that is what God says, then I'll be an enemy to your enemy and I'll be an adversary to your adversaries. In other words, to obey the angel is to obey God. The angel in Exodus, here and in other places, in my opinion, is a manifestation of God and does not refer to a being distinct from God himself. Think about it this way. In the ancient Near East, the line of demarcation between the sender and the sent are many times blurred. In the final analysis, the angel of God is simply God acting. Purpose the angel will serve is to protect Israel during the wilderness journey and in the course of the conquest, according to verse 20. And as the angel guards you, Israel, on your journey in this desolate place, and as you face the challenges of the conquest, as the angel guards you, guard yourselves and do not transgress the instructions. In both cases, the word guard is the same Hebrew term, shamar. If Israel is obedient, then God will be an enemy to Israel's enemies and an adversary to Israel's adversaries. God's angel, that is God himself, will go before the people. He will eliminate their enemies before them, and he will bring them into the promised land. The context here is the conquest. And notice who the enemies of God are. Who are they? They are those who would keep Israel out of the promised land. Those are God's enemies. These are the enemies that he will overcome. We have to be careful not to equate the theocracy of the 15th century BC with secular 21st century Israel. But I wouldn't take this concept too lightly. Who are God's enemies? Well, among others, God's enemies are those who would keep Israel out of the promised land. God's enemies are those who would instead claim it for themselves. And God's enemies are those whose goal it is to push Israel out of Canaan into the Mediterranean Sea. This is made clear in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 1 through 7, which we don't have time to read today. Though our larger context here is not the conquest, we're all aware of the difficulties some people have with the violence and the difficulties with what Israel is asked to do with respect to the conquest of Canaan. It would be out of our topic today to try to give an overly simplistic answer to a very complex topic, but if you look at verse 23, it bears mentioning what God says here. Verse 23, he says, I will completely destroy them. The conquest was about bringing Israel into the promised land, but it was also about bringing judgment on the Canaanites for centuries of idolatry and perverse cultural practices. And God had already prophesied this in the 15th chapter of Genesis to Abraham when he said, you're going to have to wait to take possession of the land. And one of the reasons you're going to have to wait, other than the fact that you don't have any descendants yet to live there, is that the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet fulfilled. God says, I will completely destroy them. It is his right to do so. He is just and he is righteous in bringing whatever judgment he chooses on the Canaanites. And that is what happens at the conquest. The conquest was God's doing. It was God's decision. And the instrument of the conquest that he uses to bring about his will is the nation of Israel. As I emphasized earlier, I don't remember if it was in the Genesis context or the Exodus context, God can do more than one thing at once. He is capable of bringing his people into the promised land on the one hand and using that very thing as an instrument of justice and judgment against the indigenous peoples there. One other thing that's interesting to me is most English translations, after listing all these peoples, you know, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and it could go on. These are the ones who are being judged. Most of the English translations say, I will completely destroy them, which is probably how we would naturally say that phrase in English. But the Hebrew text reads, I will completely destroy him. It's singular. I don't want to push it too far, but it seems to me reasonable that this use of the singular, the word him, is used instead of the plural to emphasize the entire population of peoples as a singular body of people. In other words, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, Hivites, etc., as a group, will be blotted off the face of the earth. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. And I'm assure you that I've never in my life met a Hivite. There are none. Of all these peoples, there are two of those designations which are sometimes used to refer to all of the peoples. And that's the word Canaanite, which can mean, you know, Canaanite, but it can also mean Hivite. It would be covered. It's an umbrella term. And the other umbrella term seems to be Amorite. That's the term that was used in Exodus 15, the iniquity of the Amorite, that is all the indigenous peoples, was not yet full. These little communities, like Ugarit, we talk about the Ugaritic language. All that is the dialect of the people at Ugarit. The dialect of the Jebusites is Hebrew. So if you wanted to think about the Hebrew language in a little broader context, it's Jebusite. So all of these little groups, the Hivites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Ugarites or whatever they were called, they all had their little versions of Northwest Semitic, which is the language group. And sometimes they're viewed as a body or as a group, which is, I think, what's in view here, and sometimes, for whatever reason, they're looked at as individuals. The point of what Troy's bringing up is that though you have this group that lives on this side of the mountain and this group that lives on this side of the river and this group that lives on the other side of the valley, they were tribally separate, but culturally they shared the same culture. Is that essentially what you're saying? And so these hymns that you find in the Ugaritic language were not just stories that were pertinent to Ugarit. They were pervasive throughout the whole land of Canaan. And it was a theology and a worldview and a psychology and a anthropology and any other ologies you can think of that were shared by all of these little separate tribal groups. Verses 23 through 26. Here God once again commands Israel to avoid entanglements with the Canaanite idolatry, and he instructs his people, as he's done already in the Ten Commandments, to worship only Yahweh. And it seems that he's not satisfied with just an impassive tiptoeing around these idolatrous entanglements. He is very proactive here because passive avoidance is not sufficient. Israel to destroy utterly all vestiges of the Canaanite religion. Then the text goes on to say that if Israel will obey the Lord in this manner, he'll bless the people. He'll give them food and water. He'll remove sickness from their midst. He'll make the people fruitful, and he will attribute to them long life in the land of promise, both individually and corporately. You have to understand, these are promises given to Israel. These are not promises that specifically and directly apply to us. These are promises that apply to Israel in the land of Canaan. Not that we cannot draw certain applications from them, but these are promises that are strictly given to the people of Israel. It also does not mean that in every single instance of every life, that a life of faith will necessarily result in a long life and plenty of food and water and no health issues. These are general truths that if you obey me, it will be better for you than if you don't. They are proverbial, as in proverb, to some degree. In the Hebrew, it says obeying if you obey. It's that infinitive absolute finite verb construction that underscores and intensifies the meaning of the verb. And we translate that, instead of saying obeying, obey, we say truly obey or surely die, or, you know, however we want to draw that line of emphasis there. But he is calling attention to that. We always have to be on guard against the combining of our faith and magic. If you look around the religious world, you will find people who put a lot of emphasis on things like this, or venerated objects, or certain phrases that we say at the end of a prayer that we think somehow does something. We're not immune from these same potential pitfalls that Israel faced. Keep in mind there were trade routes that ran back and forth between Egypt and the Middle East. This area where they are is the center of all the trade routes. They all fan out from there. So as the caravans came in from Egypt, they heard stories about what God did to the Egyptians. They've heard stories about what happened at the Red Sea. They will hear stories about how God fights on behalf of Israel. You'll see that phrase a lot. You know, back in the 15th chapter, those verses I read there, it said, you know, the people of Edom heard this and they trembled, and the land of Philistines, you know, they all had heard the stories. They were all very concerned. So let's think about this. I'll send my terror ahead of you. In the same sense that the angel is a manifestation of God working for the benefit of his people, here, this idea of my terror carries the meaning of God working to bring judgment to the inhabitants of Canaan. In both cases, it's God working. In one case, to bless his people. In the other case, to bring judgment. If an Egyptian who had just seen God at work through the 10th plague heard this verse, no further explanation of what it means would be necessary. Likewise, the hornets are symbolic, I think, as well. The term zirah means hornet, but it also means skin disease. It's the same word that was used back in the fourth chapter of Exodus, verse 6, where God gave the signs to Moses that he was to do before Pharaoh. Throw down your staff and turn to a serpent. Take your hand, put it in your cloak. Remove it, it's leprous. Put it back in, it's healed. That phrase, leprous, is the same word translated hornet here. So I don't think that we are supposed to think of these as actual wasp slash bee type creatures. The point is that in response to obedience, God will act on behalf of Israel to bring them into the promised land. That is, he'll bless them. And in response to rebellion, he'll send his terror against the Canaanites to bring judgment. In fact, if you look at modern Arabic today, the modern Arabic term for mass panic is derived from the word hornet. So in all of these verses back in the 15th chapter of Exodus and earlier in chapter 23, when it talks about the people more or less being in a state of panic and turning their backs and running, It all has to do with God creating in them this paralyzing fear that God fights for Israel. And if we oppose these people, we oppose their God. In the closing verses, 30 through 33, God explains to the people that the conquest will not occur overnight. It's not going to be a single battle, or it's not going to be one day or one year, but it's going to be something that happens methodically over time. He gives them two reasons for this. One is you need to grow into your ability to fill the land. Apparently there was not sufficient population for Israel to take over the land, but maybe more importantly, this gives Israel an opportunity to trust the Lord and see His works over a longer period of time. They've seen the instantaneous miracle. Nothing's going to ever surpass what happened at Yom Suf at the Red Sea. But here they have an opportunity to trust God methodically over time as He progressively and faithfully fulfills His promise to the people over time. Then in verse 31, He sets the borders for Israel. Finally, in His last command, God gives to Israel, which He uses to conclude the chapter. He says, you're not to make any covenants with these Canaanites. You're not to associate them with them, lest you be drawn into their idolatrous practices against which you have been warned. If we were to look for just a couple of words to summarize the purpose and content of the Book of the Covenant, Israel's body of applied law given to them by God, we might simply say that the Book of the Covenant sets the parameters for the cultic worship and the social interactions of Israel, the people of God, in the land of Canaan. The laws, the warnings, the blessings are Israel's. Just as the Ten Commandments laid out the timeless principles on which these laws are based, so the Book of the Covenant governs Israel's worship and practice, and it establishes the laws under which the people are to conduct their daily lives. Idolatry, the failure to follow the first two commandments by recognizing Yahweh as the only God, was punishable by death, as were sorcery and certain sexual aberrations, which either failed to recognize God's sovereignty and His creation or violate the patterns that He established when He created the world. By far the worst deviation from what God intended for His people would be involvement in pagan worship. And much of the Book of the Covenant that we've studied exists to direct Israel away from this idolatry and the death sentence that it carries. Every man, Jew and Gentile alike, has within him an old sin nature. This old sin nature is vulnerable to temptation, and it is the temptation of the Canaanite culture that God warns against in these concluding statements. I think we would do well to take heed to the intent of the warning, for we live in a culture that more and more is taking on the character and the traits of the Canaanite culture of biblical times. That concludes the study of the Book of the Covenant. Next week we're going to look at the ratification of the covenant, and we're going to do something a little bit different next week. I'm going to take the first half of the class and talk about the ratification of this covenant at Sinai. And then Wendell's going to take the second half of the class and touch on some very significant insights that he has come up with in his preparation of this curriculum for the seminaries in Cuba.